This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I am your host, Dan Benamor. Today, we're talking about the 2013 film Grand Piano. The film stars Elijah Wood, John Cusack, and Carrie Bichet. Eugenio Mira directed the film. It holds a 79% on Rotten Tomatoes. Damien Chazelle, who made Whiplash and La La Land, wrote the script. Eugenio has also served as second unit director on some huge movies like Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. My guest today is the director of this film, Eugenio Mira. Welcome, Eugenio.
Nice to meet you. Hello to everybody. I'm so excited to be here.
Am I horribly bungling the pronunciation of your first name?
Oh, Mira. Mira is great. It's Mira in Spanish. So Mira sounds, you had Miramax, not the best name to make a reference to in 2021.
How do you say Eugenio? Is it?
Well, Eugenio sounds more like an Italian thing. It's Eugenio. It sounds more like a Hebrew. I got a hard thing, but I'm so accustomed to, because a lot of people call me Eugene here in Spain. So that's the irony of it. So right. Eugenio is just like a beautiful bastardization of the whole thing. So I'm fine. Eugenio is fine.
Okay. The first thing that jumped out at me, I'm not great at math, but Damien Chazelle is still a young guy right now, which means that when he wrote this script, was he like 12 years old? Like, how old was he when he wrote this?
Well, just to have some context, when I met Damien, it was made clear to me that this was a script that this young kid wrote in with the intention of directing himself back in the day. I don't know when that was exactly. The first time that I read the script in long feature form was in 2011, right after I made my second film, Agnosia, as a director. And I was approached by Nostromo Pictures, this Spanish production company that had a lot of success with Buried, this film with Ryan Reynolds in a coffin, directed by my friend Rodrigo Cortez.
Right.
And that was it. They had some traction regarding thrillers and stuff. And they said, hey, will you do something in, you know, this kind of high concept thriller? That they knew that I was a musician, that I'm a composer as well. And it felt like something that it could be interesting to me. And they were right. I read the strip. I never heard of Damien before. Little I knew what was going to happen with that guy. But I met him. And he was the sweetest guy, super shy, very passionate about movies and film history. Actually, he said that he recently moved to LA because he was so passionate about film history. Mm. And we suddenly started to talk about everything from Spielberg to Stanley Donen to musicals, Broadway musicals, and everything. We connected very much from the get-go. And yes, when he told me that was his intention, he wanted to direct the film, and his manager at the time said, hey, maybe it's better if you sell the script to, you know, put it out there, and you gain some traction, and hopefully you will be able to make your short film. It happened to be a first iteration of Whiplash. Wow. So I remember that when he visited to us in Barcelona, where we shot the film, because we built in a huge stage, the theater, and he was impressed, you know, seeing this. You know, we shot in 35 millimeters. He was like mind blown about that, because back in the day, in the industry, it was rare, and we in Spain, we were still transitioning. So he told me about this thing. Hey, do you mind taking a look to this thing that I made? Like, super humble. Like, if I were some kind of, I don't know, older guy or something. And yes, I saw it and I loved it. And then he went to Sundance and was a sensation. And that's when, if I don't recall wrong, it was Jason Blum showed up and said, hey, let's make a movie out of this. And the rest is history. So that's exactly my moment in the middle of it, like seeing this guy like suddenly trespassing everything and becoming the next Martin Scorsese.
It's so funny. I remember when I was a journalist, I got to interview Tony Gilroy before Michael Clayton came out. And Tony Gilroy obviously was a very accomplished writer, but had not really directed prior. And I spoke to him, and like kind of what you're describing, he was so humble about it. And it's like a movie starring George Clooney. It was obviously an extraordinary movie. And he's like, was the print okay? Like, you know, and I just, you know, it's so interesting when you look back on it and see these guys kind of before this thing exploded, what, you know, what it was like. And it's right. You know, it's the same for all of us, I guess. It's just hoping that it will work.
Well, I've been close to people that it's been incredibly successful, and you can write volumes, speak volumes about the concept of hotness that is so stupid if you think about it. We live enough to see several moments across a career with actors and directors that suddenly it's like, where's this guy? I mean, he made this great thing. Suddenly you don't hear about them. And especially in the US, you can see that. I would say the European perspective of the US when it comes to careers is that you can literally reinvent yourself more than 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
And we see it all the time. But yes, I think that working with Elijah, for example, I mean, somebody that, you know, he's Frodo for Christ's sake, and how he's been using that energy to divert it and do what he really wants to do, that is produce interesting films, boutique films that are crafted with care, you know, and be part of those films as a producer, some other times, including himself as an actor. I love Elijah, by the way, and I hope that we join forces together anytime soon, because we keep in touch and we keep track of what's both of us doing. But yes, you can see different. With Damien, I had this image, and to this day, I think that he's kept that, his passion for film. It's his main driving force. You see other directors or actors, whatever, that they become more accustomed to that perception of them. And with Damien, he's using all that to make what for him is the most important thing ever, that it's making films.
Yeah, Elijah Wood, I met him as well through the production company where I was a development executive. And for the audience, for people who maybe are not as familiar with this, he created this company called SpectreVision. And what he loves is he's like a super horror nerd. And so he loves like very weird, like they at the time sent us a bunch of scripts they were working on. And it was like really kind of edgy, off the wall type of stuff. So while it may seem to the, and particularly maybe more this time now since he's done a bunch of movies like that, but when he kind of pivoted into doing this stuff, it might have seemed strange to the outside audience, but anybody who knew him at all would know that this is like exactly what he wanted to do.
It's exactly that. And again, I always said when working with him as an actor, and we'll get to that specifically about Grand Piano, it was clear that he was a member of the crew in a way that he wanted to understand all the pieces that made every single shot possible.
Yeah.
And to facilitate it from his vast experience, because he's been working since he's been a kid with people like names like Richard Donner, Robert Zemeckis. Imagine to somebody like me, the Spanish kid that saw all this. I'm 43 now. So in the 80s, I was watching these films like The Goonies, Back to the Future, Star Wars, everything that become now is like untouchable. And unfortunately to reference in a bad way, that's my opinion. So it's like, I don't care as much about the revival than what those films were back in the day, how well crafted they were. Because people talk about nostalgia, but in my case, it's like, hey, wait a second. These movies were actually very, very well laid out. And there's so much to learn about them, about, you know, filmmaking. You could be making a drama and learn something from Back to the Future, you know, and not just about special effects or funny jokes or whatever. But yes, with him, geeking out with Elijah is very easy. You suddenly find yourself sharing this fascination for both sides, the impact of the spell, as I said, and how those spells are crafted. That is what I personally changed my life when I was a kid. I mean, I have to say that I'm here because I'm still fascinated by the craft. It's the only thing that you never learn enough. You can be more or less talented, or more or less lucky or ambitious or whatever. But the craft is that thing that you only can get to know slightly better. And there's all this field to improve all the time. And I'm passionate about that. That's what I've been doing between projects. I mean, trying to keep that in mind and collaborate with keeping in contact with people that share the same passion and the same work ethos that I do.
Yeah, you know, that'll lead into my first question. So I'll just quickly run through some of the plot. So we meet Tom Selznick. He's played by Elijah Wood. He was an up-and-coming concert pianist until he developed stage fright while attempting to play a complex piece called La Cinquette. 5 years later, he is slated to appear in Chicago for a comeback performance dedicated to the memory of his late mentor, the pianist and composer Patrick Godereau, who composed La Cinquette. Godereau posthumously acquired massive media coverage due to the mysterious disappearance of his vast fortune. Tom's return to the stage is prompted by the encouragement of his actress-singer wife, Emma, played by Carrie Boucher. As Tom arrives at the theater, his friend Norman is the conductor. assures him he's going to perform well, but he makes a point to say that the music is so dense that it is inevitable that he is going to hit a wrong note. It's impossible. There's no way that he can play it perfectly. And, you know, the first act in a movie like this, you got to take a good 25 minutes because you're going to be trapped in the high concept for the rest of the movie. So you got to take a good 25 minutes to just kind of set everything up. And what I thought was so impressive about it is that even during the first act, which is all set up, the way the film is shot, the way the images are composed, the movement of the camera, it still feels very tense. And De Palma, in that great documentary about De Palma, he talks about, he feels like he's one of the last people who picked up Hitchcock's cinematic language and tried to carry it forward, and that he was one of the last practitioners of it. And watching this, I very strongly felt not just Hitchcock, but then specifically De Palma's version of Hitchcock. And I was curious if there was specific movies from either of them that were real touchstones for you in making this.
Well, it's obviously, first of all, you have, Damien should have part of the credit for this, because when he wrote the script and you read it, it was screaming De Palma all over the way here and there. Actually was surprised that he didn't play with, the great thing about Damien is that he's very rich when it comes to references. And obviously I thought when it comes to Hitchcock, I thought about the man who knew too much, and then, you know, Phantom of the Paradise with De Palma using music and all that. But it's true that I had to make a very important decision at the very beginning. Is like, okay, am I going to go against the nature of the script as it reads, or am I just going to, you know, succumb to it and say, okay, I'm here to do this the best experience possible, and maybe introduce other things here and there. And I went for the second. I considered for a moment trying to do something more abstract or not so strongly attached to the point of view of the main character, but then you realize that that's what Hitchcock did better than anybody else. He was so good to, but one of the films that blew my mind when I was a kid was Rope. You know, when you see that, you see these two guys that kill a third person that is in a coffee, this kind of table. And then until Jimmy Stewart shows up at the party and he starts to frown and say, what the hell, what's going on? The tension is there from the very beginning. You know, you have this kind of, Hitchcock was very good sharing information in advance to the audience, so you could see the main characters suffering. And some of the time, there's very little occasions in Hitchcock movies when you see the characters being in advanced, you know, in advantage. So again, if you read the script, Damien clearly knew what he was doing, and I just went like all in. It's like, okay, there's no place, no room for a prudishness about this. It's like, let's do it, let's embrace it, and let's go crazy about it and be consistent. And it's a privilege. I see it as a gift. I mean, that script, the movie itself as a whole was a thing that I had to say, do I really want to do this? And then it's like, wait a second, there's an interesting thing to talk about. And it was everything regarding talent and satisfaction and fulfillment and success and how all those things mean completely different things. And at that moment in my life, I still had this punk cynicism of kind of a teenager, despite I was in my 30s. But I felt like, okay, I'm going to say a couple of things about that, or what I've learned about being successful, what the hell that means when we're, you know, in this world. Back in the day, in 2012 is when you started to see all this Instagram and social media thing and what is being famous, you know, and what is being successful and fulfilled by your art. And I think that there's a lot of that with Damien. I talked about it. I tried to underline those things to make sure that it wasn't just a vehicle of expression for cinematic joy. And it is, but at the same time, you have all the thing, you know, the satisfaction of doing what happens when you've done something and you're being, you know, satisfied with your performance, but at the same time, you feel void. All those tiny little things, I found them very interesting in the script, and I tried to underline them.
Yeah, so that connects to the next thing I wanted to talk about. So a house usher hands Tom a folder of sheet music. Within, he finds the music for La Cinquette and discards it. Then during the concert, he finds a note written on a sheet music that reads, play one wrong note and you die. Believing it to be a prank, he ignores it, only to find further notes that threaten Emma, as well as a laser dot that tracks his movement. Just a 1,000-yard view of this, it could be this absurd premise where you kind of lose the audience 15 minutes into it. And what keeps me in it, I think, is the filmmaking, because I think you found every possible creative way to film a guy playing a piano. every possible way you could shoot it. It's so dynamic. And then the other thing was like the connection of the music to the filmmaking, to just the integral part of the music reminded me so much of Whiplash, thematically so much of Whiplash. And I was curious, do you have a background in music at all? Because it's the music is so critical to this.
Well, that's funny. I'm actually, my first contact with the craft of writing music and performing music came before than cinema itself, because my parents, I come from a very humble family, but they met each other studying arts, and they decided to, you know, be together and have a family while they were finishing their, studying. So me and my sister from the very beginning were in this beautiful environment of, you know, they are not, I'm not going to say that they are like the most big fans of cinema or music, but we were definitely surrounded by that environment. And they decided to, it said, if you like it, would you like to play piano? And I said, yes. So actually, grand piano is an opportunity to talk about my own anxiety being 4 years old and being like this kid that apparently is good with instruments. And then that expires. It gets really rough at a certain point and you lose interest when you're a teenager. And my parents never forced me to do it. So I never had this antagonist kind of or hate to the instrument. To the contrary, I developed this relationship to see the piano as an instrument for writing music and composing music. And that's what I did, is like, say, I'm not a performer. I don't enjoy performing. I sweat a lot and suffer this anxiety. It makes no sense. It's completely irrational. But I love writing music. So I write music for most of my films. My two first films, The Birthday and Agnosia, I wrote the soundtrack. And in Grand Piano, I collaborated with Victor Reyes, who made an incredible job. Adapting some of my demos that were demanding dynamics and changes. Also, let's say that I made this kind of Frankenstein version using pieces and creating like little guides that allow me to design the musical set pieces, the 4 or 5 set pieces that you can see. It's not that I wrote the music that you end up listening, but I was making this report about what I needed and the build-ups, and then and talking sometimes even in very high detail about the harmony, all servicing this feeling that everything is happening at the same time. So yes, I mean, definitely that was one of the reasons why I wanted to make Grand Piano, to kind of dust off all those skills regarding music.
Yeah, it's interesting the part you mentioned about the anxiety of playing the piano, right? So disturbed, Tom leaves the stage, shocking the audience. He returns to his dressing room, where he receives a text that instructs him to locate and wear an earpiece, allowing him to communicate with the would-be assassin Clem, played by John Cusack. When Tom returns to the stage, Clem demonstrates that he can shoot his silenced rifle into the floor next to Tom and no one notices. And Cusack's character keeps reinforcing this idea that Elijah needs to play perfectly. This is the concert of his life. This is like the culmination of his life almost. And Whiplash is really about is that conversation, I think it's Miles Davis maybe, where they say, you know, his teacher threw the cymbals at him and that made him a better jazz player, basically. And the question being like, does an insane, harmful amount of pressure actually make you perform better? That's very clearly in Whiplash, and it's also very clearly in this movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's such a major theme, first of all, in Chazelle's writing, but then also how do you connect to that theme?
Well, I think that for Damien, clearly he had a more his relationship with music. It really had more to do with performing than composing. I think when you open your mind to composing, you're in control. It changes everything. So you start to see performing as a, I'm not gonna say that a lesser kind of form of expression. It's just that it's part of a thing that you focus on. This other thing that it feels more magical than just being like this kind of human drum machine that has to hit the right notes and do what it has to do. But yes, I think that in Damien, for example, as a person, you don't have to see his interviews. He's very introverted and shy. And it's part of his personality. I think the way that he's incredibly, I mean, he's immensely talented. I'm not saying this based on his success that he had. It was clear when you talk to him, his passion and how devoted he was to the craft. And that guy, if he wouldn't been that successful, he will be just, you know, hitting the wall again and again and again until you know, his sticks, because that's what you can feel that he's got this driving force. That doesn't mean that he doesn't suffer in the process. And I think that these two scripts are two sides of it's not a reflection of each other. One has to do with success, and another one has to do with killing the mentor in a way. So in Grand Piano, the mentor is dead. You know, is this ghost figure, the Patrick Guderau. It's there. It's like the healthy side of the upbringing of Tom Selznick. It's most probably he will be saying, like, it doesn't matter if you fail a couple of notes. It's not about that. It's about expression. And then you get Cusack, that is kind of the pressure of society, you know, and fame and all that bullshit. That is especially coming from people that has no clue about music or art or anything, but are there, like, you see that, you know, with X Factor or any, we've seen that in TV in the last 15 years. All this validation is the word. How artists are looking validation by people that is like, why is this guy or this woman telling me that I made a good job or not? What kind of validation am I looking for? You know, and I think that Grand Piano is more, it's darker in the way that it's not about the skill, it's about the recognition. And with Whiplash, it's more about the hubris of the guy that is performing saying, no, I know I'm this good. Fuck this guy. Sorry if I'm for cursing. But you know, and I think that Damien explored these two sides of the that had to do with perception and self-esteem. Mm. And I think it's different. And I embrace the difference. Again, remember that when I made Grand Piano, all reference that I had about Whiplash was this short film that I saw when we end up shooting this in Barcelona. Something that he sent me, I saw it and I reviewed it and I loved it. But then everything exploded and changed. So something tells me that maybe Grand Piano precedes Whiplash in Damien's mind, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
More naive approximation to what is succeeding, more than the inner process of becoming an artist as good as you believe that you deserve to become into.
Right. Oh, that is, my cat has just jumped into the baby's crib and turned
on. Oh my God.
Boy. So
I hope the kid is okay.
No, the kid's not here. If the kid was here, this would definitely be a louder interview. I'm gonna keep moving to the plot. So desperate, Tom uses his cell phone to contact his friend Wayne. Wayne really does his best to try to help him out, but then the usher, who we find out is Clem's assistant, kills Wayne, and then he tells Clem tells Tom to look up, and Wayne's body is sprawled across the rafters. Wayne's girlfriend Ashley leaves the hall in search of him, but she is also killed by the usher. Again, this is like the most, this is the ne plus ultra of De Palma. So the killing of Ashley, the usher takes her head and smashes it into a glass, which breaks. Then he takes one of the slithers of glass and uses it to slit her throat. At one point, there's like a POV shot and you get a reflection. And then he slits her throat and there's a match cut to a bow across a cello. I mean, that stuff is just so good. That's just really classic.
Oh, man.
Filmmaking.
I have to say that I'm in my circles, I'm very well known for storyboard everything and being, to me, pre-production it's a joke, because if I only can get to pre-production if I know what I'm doing, to share it with the crew. It's not, I don't use pre-production to figure out what the movie is. I tend to start months before in my intimacy, and try to get as far as I can without having a production designer or a director of photography to talk to. So in this particular case, that particular moment, I have to say, against my work ethos, this happened during the shoot. I remember that I was like peeing myself, like, oh my God, I had to escape to WC. I went there, there was a crack in a mirror, and I thought about this, oh, wouldn't it be great if when the usher, you know, played by the amazing Alex Winter, by the way, that I love him so much, and is an incredibly talented filmmaker, and I had a great time with him. What if, because of the crack, you know, you take the crack and use it to, and then the match cut, everything came one thing after another. I remember that with my assistant director, Javier Soto, I told him, man, sit there for a moment, for a second. I took my phone and we shot it. I made the whole thing like in 5 minutes, this little demo of how the shot will work, and like a week before we end up shooting it. So it was a very exciting moment of saying, it doesn't matter how hard you work in pre-production and trying to anticipate. Sometimes there are these beautiful ideas that only can happen when you're in the moment.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I must say that I will be in trouble if I only relied on those magic moments, then you're in trouble, you know? So it's just this thing that you can allow yourself to do, especially for a film like Grand Piano that is so demanding when it comes to designing it in advance. But yeah, there was room for, I'm not going to say improvisation, but let's call it reaction, you know, to the environment and the muses.
So that kind of brings us to the intermission of the story. And we will also take our intermission here of the episode, and we will be right back for really the, much like Whiplash reaches this sort of crazy crescendo involving music and stuff, this movie does as well. We'll be right back for that. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed, you get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. Their pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So Clem further reveals that there's like a lock in the piano that has a key to a safety deposit box and Gotaro. You know, Clem was the locksmith, and he created this elaborate mechanism where it's like you have to play the piano perfectly and then you get the key to open the box. That brings me back to what you said at the beginning when you were like, should I just embrace what the script is or kind of try to go a different way? Because it is absurd intrinsically. There's no getting around it. So it's kind of one of those things where you're either just totally embracing it as this operatic thing. If you were to try to say like, well, should we really try to hold this up to the most logical scrutiny? Immediately, it's like a fool's errand, right? What was the challenge? What was the conversation about that with the script development?
To me, it was like one of the first conversation that I have with the producers is like, hey, I read the script and you told me that, you know, the people in my talent agency loved it and the actors are loving it. And it's like, I wonder what the hell they're talking about, because this is ridiculous. This is crazy. I said, are you sure that you want to, are you out of your mind? And that's when I decided that there was only one way to go. That it's like, okay, let's embrace it from the very beginning. We're in a documentary about this talented pianist that was forced to play at gunpoint. And let's make it, to be honest, the car that I used, and I hope that it feels that way when you watch the film, is at the very beginning. And maybe I should have invested more energy on that, but I want to make sure that maybe all this thing about the voice in his head was some sort of an illusion, you know, a manifestation of his own kind of paranoia. And even if that's not the case, that's how I kind of shot it. I shot it and I talked to Elijah. It's like, when you talk about this voice in your earpiece, it's not different to this kind of inner voice of a demon or something. Somebody that is showing up there, whispering terrible things to you and trying to destabilize you. Maybe it's your own inability to play, manifesting in the shape of a voice of John Cusack. So out of that, I mean, basically, as I said, it was like embracing the crazy aspect of the script, the whimsical tone, the kind of musical dark comedy that it had. I love the Coen brothers, for example. I say that they are the kings of suspension of disbelief, and suddenly they betray you doing something that is so harsh and naturalistic that is like, holy shit, you didn't see that coming. It happens in No Country for Old Men, for example. It is one of the most grounded thing. And you have Javier Bardem's character that is like a cartoon, and it's scary. And with that hair and that and those lines and that way of moving, it's like, what the hell am I seeing? And it works so well because the Coen brothers, well, maybe that's the way to go. And not everybody can pull it off as well as them. But what I'm saying is that there's always room. You can do Raising Arizona or Miller's Crossing, or you know, or every movie speaks by itself and it has its own tone. And I think the Grand Piano, there was only this way to approach it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe another director could have tried to make this as a grounded thriller. I think that it's ridiculous trying to do it. I quit. I'm not even going to try it.
Yeah. So during intermission, Tom runs backstage in search of the crumpled manuscript so he can play Lysenko at the sheet music. He finds the janitor has destroyed it. He returns to his dressing room, listens to the piece on a tablet that Emma had given him earlier. He takes notes to help himself remember. Norman says that Tom's solo performance is going to be the Tempest Sonata, but Tom interrupts him and says he's going to play Les Enquête. I cannot even imagine the technical challenges of like making it look like Elijah Wood is playing as the music. That must have been a practical nightmare. Clem warns Tom to pace himself so as not to wear himself out. Tom plays the piece completely free of error until he gets to the very last note, which he deliberately misplays, infuriating Clem. Tom realizes basically that the audience doesn't know the difference. The audience loves it anyway. And so he realizes for himself that it doesn't matter if you don't do it absolutely perfect. They're not going to know. He ignores Clem's shouted threats, introduces Emma kind of to the audience, like says, hey, oh, she's going to come on and sing. And it's a way of drawing every eye to her so that if they try to kill her, which they've been threatening to do, it would be too obvious. They would kind of out themselves. So the usher realizes, hey, the plan is screwed. He kind of runs to flee. Clem shoots him. Tom runs off stage, finds the usher's corpse. Clem comes out of the shadows. They have a fight on the catwalk. And I want to just do a few minutes on Cusack here because, you know, I think Cusack, at times, I think Cusack can be a little bit miscast as the heavy. I mean, he's certainly played some of those roles in his career. And I think that here, he is so dialed in. I think it's one of his certainly great villain performances, but I think also just his vocal performance is so good.
Yeah.
And again, because I have this development background, this is just me guessing based on how I know movies are financed. Is this like Cusack comes in for like a day and a half and just lays it down, or how much time do you have with him to get this?
Something like that. I mean, actually, when it comes to the shoot, he was like, I will say that it was like a short week, maybe 3-4 days in Barcelona full time. And we recorded some of the stuff. But then when the movie was cut, we went through ADR sessions, and we have these emails like saying, well, basically, I mean, kind of cooking in advance how it was going to be. But he's incredibly talented. I mean, I remember sitting with my producer, Rodrigo Cortez, and the recording sessions when the movie was already cut. And it was a joy. I only had to say a couple of, you know, things. It's like, oh, maybe we should do another one that is not that whispered. And he was like, thumbs up, went through it, and it was perfect. So, yeah. Well, I cannot say how amazing was working with Elijah and John Cusack for this project, because they're incredibly professional. I mean, they're amazing. They have a ton of experience, and it's a joy to see them together.
These guys that are such good actors, I've been fortunate. Now I'm producing these scripted podcasts, which my audience knows about, and so I'm getting to work with some really accomplished actors, and they're so good. For their first take is always good to start with, and then it's like you have maybe one note. And you give them the note, and they so take the note, and then they do it 10 times better. Like, it's just, if you give them an inch, they're like, I got it. And they just fly.
It's exactly that. I mean, they see it, they see it, how to make it part of in a very organic way. And it's mind blowing. You're sitting there. I personally, as a director, I don't think that directing actors, well, there's different ways to do it. And I think that every actor is different, and they have different demands. But when you work with somebody that is so good at the craft of acting, and by the craft I mean that they can switch on and switch off the character and deliver it and respect the marks, and in this incredibly demanding project where every shot had like 7 different marks, I had to tell you, imagine we have John Cusack's voice and the PA, but then we had Elijah, and there was the music in his earpiece, and then we were like turning down the music so we could record the live, dialogues. And then the camera tilts down and you see the only part that Elijah learned perfectly to play, that it's just for that specific moment. So if you tilt up and down at the wrong time, you see that he's not able to play anything because the commitment was to learn only the stuff that we asked him beforehand. If you don't have actors like those, it will be impossible. On the other hand, if we shot this film in a traditional way, more like based on coverage, that I hate coverage, it will be impossible. It will be the most boring film ever. It will be very hard to create the dynamic that it has just based on editing, because a close-up, that's not going to give you the dynamics of the script and end.
It's so funny you say that, because like in the De Palma documentary, he talks about that a bunch of times where he's like, oh yeah, that's exciting. Shot, reverse shot over the shoulder. Like, he's like, you know, and that's why De Palma is so great. And that's why this movie is so great, is that it's all like that. Every single move is like, you know, like two people are just having a conversation. The camera goes here, the music, the way they look, like it's all so composed. So just to kind of wrap up the plot here, in the ensuing struggle, Clem kind of, you know, dangles Tom over the catwalk. Tom kind of drags him. He falls into the piano. They both kind of crash. That moment is, again, beautifully staged. I had a huge smile on my face as he like slammed his piano. Tom lands to the side and survives. Emma rushes over to him. They embrace. He tells her, I think I broke my leg. They're waiting for the ambulance. You know, now it's sort of like the aftermath, right? The police sirens are there, all that. Tom notices the obliterated piano being loaded into a shipping truck, and plays the last four bars of La Cinquette, which were supposed to like turn the key or the lock or whatever. And then he hears the key hit the floor. He bends down to pick it up. We cut to black. That's the end of the movie. I want to talk about just quickly, and again, just from my experience with independent film, this movie easily could have not been good, which is to say that my
experience, I totally hear you.
Yeah, my experience with independent film financing is like, you kind of cobble it together through a combination of foreign sales, tax credits, international co-production. You know, you have X amount of days to shoot. Usually what ends up happening is you start, you know, a lot of the movies I work, it's like, well, it'll be 24 days. Then it's like, well, 19. That's like, 16. And then by the time you finish. So the way that these movies are designed sometimes is actually the enemy of the filmmaker, because the movie being good is against the financial best interest of financing the movie at times.
Right.
So can you talk about how hard it was to make this a legitimately great movie that is competitive with totally any studio movie or anything like that?
Oh, thank you, man. I have to say that the most important thing was the confidence and trust between me and the producers, Adrian Guerra and Rodrigo Cortez, Nostromo Pictures. We've been, you know, close for decades. And we love the stuff that we do. So from the very beginning, there was no secrets. It was like, this is what we got, this is the time that we have. And I said, well, there's only one way to succeed in making this film. And it's if I don't wait until pre-production to figure out how we're gonna make it.
Yeah.
So I remember that I started working on some demos and some animatics and stuff to show them as producers. It's like, this is what I think that this production demands in terms of what we have to do in advance. We have to write the music before. We have to make sure that some scenes need to have 3D animatics. Some others are going to be this kind of mockups that we're going to do with a cell phone and then cut it together in iMovie. It's not a big deal. We can do it. Anybody can do it on the, you know, with a laptop. But that's the great thing. They said, I understand. I mean, this is off the chart. I mean, you are not, it's not that we're going to pay you for this, but
of course.
If we were walking in your shoes, we will do them exactly the same. Right. So I said, hey, of course I'm going to do it. I'm not going to get into this crazy project if I don't buy my confidence. And it was like the three little pigs. I started like with the concrete and steel, and then it's in reverse, you know, the story. And suddenly when we get to shoot, there was no wolf, you know, there was no mystery, no danger. It was like, we knew exactly what we had to do. There were things that we only made like four shots. Some of the things it was like 10 shots because they were big pieces. You know, if you see the movie and you cut it, if you break it down, it's all one piece after another. I mean, I've never made something so precisely storyboarded and defined. And that's what we knew. We were replacing stuff that we had on the timeline that were drawings of 3D animatics with the shots that we were getting. the editor was working with us next to the set. So that's the way. I mean, if we had less money, we would have made the same film, because we you can measure how far you're going, or if you're getting short to what you want to accomplish. But it was like this combined effort between the crew, the fact that we know how we work, and the fact that we literally shot the film on paper before we started shooting on the set.
And then what, you know, so the movie comes out. I think that in a way you're a victim of just changing times. Like, I think it had maybe, if it had come out 10 years prior, I think it's a studio, it's a theatrical release in a more traditional way. What was the impact of the film on your career though? Because I mean, one thing that's cool about the business is that if somebody makes a good movie, at least my sense of it is that it like it gets passed around. People are like, man, you got to watch, like within the business, it gets passed around even before the movie comes out.
I think there's a combination of things. One, that will be like a whole podcast talking about how there's a, this graphic, and you know more about that than myself, but I experienced, my wife is a producer. And as me, we are between Europe and the US, depending on different combinations of financing. And look, back in the day, this movie that was shot in 2012, we started to hear about Netflix being interested in buying the rights. And back in the day, Netflix felt like VOD or something, you know? And that, imagine how things change. And suddenly I heard in 2013, I was promoting the film, traveling everywhere. And it was like the whole David Fincher with House of Cards and Kevin Spacey's like, what? And from 2013 to 2015 is the first year that you had somebody like Colin Trevorrow directing Jurassic World, making the most successful, the biggest, you know, box office and for a summer movie in cinema history. And the remake of, I call it the remake. That's a slip that I had. The Force Awakens. You know, this is The Force Awakens. It was almost the biggest movie ever in cinema history. And that changed everything forever. That's 2015. So look, I'm 43 and I started very soon. Back in the day when I was in my 20s here in Spain, I was trying to do a short film in English here in Madrid. That was the thing. The plan was, it was the end of the 90s and I wanted to tell the world, hey, I love Fincher and Spike Jonze and Michel Gondry, all these guys making incredible commercials and great videos, and that's the background. And I think I would love to jump into that kind of wagon. The phases change every 6-7 years. Now we're in this landscape that we have no clue.
Yeah,
we have no clue. It can change every 3 months. Not to mention after the pandemic, but before the pandemic, you had the. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you can go completely nuts. So all I'm trying to do is not to think too much about the impact of things, because it's like, you never know.
Yeah.
With Grand Piano, yes, I was offered things. The premise, everything that they sent to me was kind of crazy premises and thrillers. And they were they lacked the heart that Damien Chazelle's script had, or the music aspect, or the fact that I'm a piano player myself. I have a background as that, and I connected to Damien's work. And then, this is another thing. I'm afraid that I'm one of those stupid guys that I've been always more picky than what my status allowed me to be, because I'm very ambitious. And if something works, I don't want to do it again. I want to try and do something different. And that's not how the industry works.
No.
If something works, they're going to make another season and another season and another season. And all I want to do is jump to do, okay, successful, fantastic. Can I do something completely different? And completely different is bad business. I don't complain, because thank God I had time to develop my own stuff. And I sort of got that there was these two long feature films that were beautiful, completely different, almost financed with cast. I met the cast. I don't want to say names, or there were names that felt like, oh my God, this has weight. This is going to somewhere. And because of all these changes in the industry and the platforms and all that, they crumbled. It's like, oh, we don't know. We're going to go to Netflix. Well, maybe it's an HBO. Remember to finish with this little parenthetical. George Lucas and Spielberg said in an interview when Spielberg made Lincoln that this movie was this close to be an HBO TV movie.
Right.
And he still referred to HBO as a TV movie event.
Right.
Now HBO and HBO Max, you cannot say TV because it's not. It's the only thing. We only have the platforms. You see Loki, and it's as Marvel, if not more, than Iron Man back in 2008. It's a Marvel event in Disney. So it's crazy. It is really, really exhausting to catch up with all the changes. So let's keep working. That's the only thing we can do.
That's it, man. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. That's our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. And if you dig the show, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. I want to thank my guest. I'm going to say Eugenio again because I'm so bad at the pronunciation. Mira, right. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye, man.